Alrighty, well let's go ahead and get started. My name is Phil, and I'm for those of you who don't know me, I'm one of the pastors at Terra Nova, and we are kind of the church that sponsors this thing. We kind of organize it and do all of the logistics on it, but it is by no means a Terra Nova only thing. While it did start that way, it's definitely not just that, and that's something that has really kind of become something I love about Theology at the Taproom is that so many different churches take part in this. Yeah, I think about 60% of you are from Terra Nova, and the rest are from various other churches, and that's great. I want you guys to bring your different perspectives to this study. I don't want you to hide those. I want you to bring it to the fore, bring those disagreements to the fore, and that'll make the discussion more interesting throughout. So we are starting our fall study here in the Gospel in a Pluralist Society. And Newbegin is an author that I've wanted to study for a couple of years, and I'm just sort of waiting for the right time to do so. And this seems like the right time. All right, so it's great to see you guys all again back here. It's great to see you coming from a lot of different churches. I know that many of you are coming from churches where having a theology study in a bar would probably split the church in four different ways. So you know that this isn't going to happen at your church, but we have the unique gift of being relatively new as a church. And so because of that, when someone comes to one of the pastors and says, you know, I don't really like the fact that that you guys have a theology group meeting in a bar. I just really don't like that at all. We have the privilege of being able to say, you know, I am so thankful that you expressed that opinion. Thank you so much for bringing that to our attention. You know, as far as we know, there aren't any other churches sponsoring a Theology at the Taproom, so you won't have any trouble finding another church to be a part of, because there's lots to choose from that don't do this. So that's a privilege that we have, and I recognize that a lot of you guys don't have that. So we get to do this together, and we can study some great works together. Theology at the Taproom started as kind of a combination of two of my passions, that being historical theology and high-quality microbrewed beer. So I've always felt like there needed to be a place where we could do those things together, right? Additionally, when it comes to the theology, I've always felt like there needed to be a place where we could study classic works of theology, harder works of theology. Grab a seat anywhere, James. I think there's some spots over there. You got them. Perfect. Classic works of theology written by key theologians throughout the centuries and even the millennia. We've studied Augustine going back, 1,500 years. But oftentimes in a church-sponsored Bible study or class, there are several goals that might prevent some of that from happening. Sometimes we as pastors, I'm speaking as a pastor here, are trying to create a place where a sense of community and family can be built, which means that you don't want to alienate people by being overly focused on the material, so to speak. Sometimes we create a class designed to educate people about some aspect of God's truth. But because you know that the audience will be widespread and many may know very little about theology in general, there's a tendency to want to kind of simplify things down to the lowest common denominator. And sometimes you want to set the bar high in terms of commitment and advanced preparation or reading, but you know that if learning truth is not your only goal for that particular class or Bible study, then you don't want to beat people up for showing up unprepared, because you know that they're growing and in time they'll grow in their commitment. Sometimes you want to avoid really intense theological discussion in a broader-based Bible study, because what can often happen is that you'll have a room of 15 people, and two of them will be having an amazing discussion, and everyone else is completely lost. And, of course, in those situations, some people might think that because you're having really strong disagreements with each other, that you are mad at each other, and that this vigorous debate is somehow wrong or unchristian-like. So what happens then is that people who want to be able to have a really intense, animated, theological discussion based on harder, deeper theological study find themselves shut up, stifled, looked at oddly, called a Pharisee, or just plain bored, right? And so with Theology at the Tap Room, we've tried to make it really clear that this is not a Bible study like you might be used to. Though the Bible is certainly a major influence on our discussion. It's not designed to be a place where you seek your only source of community. This is not, in Terra Nova speak, this is not a new tribe or a small group. We won't be sharing prayer requests here. We won't be hugging each other and singing Kumbaya at the end. We're not going to cry on each other's shoulders. That's just not the purpose of this group. Those things are important, and I encourage you to find true community in a small group. But that's not what this is for. Will you get to know some people here? Probably, I would think. But community building is not the goal of this group. Basic education is not the goal either. What I mean by that is that this is not designed to be a 101 class of anything. This is not designed to be a 101 class. Can you be a part of Theology at the Tap Room and still learn a ton of basic theology? Absolutely. And if you're kind of on the new end of that, you don't know a whole lot about some of the basics, I'd encourage you to pick up a good kind of a general theology book. I'm drawing a blank on the one I always recommend to people. Anybody know? Anybody can access my brain here? Shoot, I'll get it to you. Don't worry, I'll email it to you. My brain search engine doesn't always work very well. I have to have it right there. Anyway, so you'll probably learn some good theology here, but it's not necessarily Millard Erickson. That's it. Millard Erickson. There. Google just took a little longer there in the Google of my brain. Millard Erickson, if you're kind of behind. But that's not necessarily the purpose. We're not trying to kind of use this as a Theology 101 class. Theology at the Tap Room is designed to be that one space in your life where you can say anything you want to in the context of good theological discussion and know that the person across the table is not going to be mad at you. They're not going to think you're a terrible person. They're not going to be offended. In that sense, this is designed to be Theological Fight Club, okay? I want it to take on that tone. Some of you have gotten used to that, and you've learned what it means to have good disagreements and still not think badly of the person across the table from you. Keep that going, and for those of you that are new, you'll get it too. It's designed to be that one place where you can study complex theological writings and no one is going to say, maybe we should choose an easier book to read. Maybe something by Tim LaHaye, or maybe a nice Beth Moore study or something, right? Those things are, you know, have their place, I suppose. No, Tim LaHaye doesn't have his place. But we choose hard books on purpose, right? We choose those kind of books on purpose. You can use the big words here. It's okay. And if someone drops the $5 theological word and you're like, I don't know what, just say, quick explanation. And someone will give you a quick explanation of whatever complex word you're using, and then we'll go on with that. And maybe you write it down and do a little more study later on and use that as kind of an impetus to study more. The expectation, in terms of setting the bar high here, is that you will come to Theology at the Tap Room having read roughly 75 pages each month. So we meet, you know, once a month. You've got a whole month to read. The first time around, I think this time we're reading about 90 pages for the first month, and then it drops down to like 70 and then 60 for the final one. So, but the expectation is that you'll come having read those pages, ready to discuss them. The expectation is that you will have taken good notes throughout your reading so that the discussion is active, lively, and informed. If you kind of show up going, well, you know, I started that reading a month ago. It's hard for me to remember exactly. I know I had a really good question, but what? I forgot it now. That's not going to work. You got to take some notes. Write in the margins. Get a notebook and write some stuff in there. Come ready to talk about the things that confused you, that you disagreed with, that you loved, Bring it all, and that's a part of your discussion time. Many of you will probably extend your research beyond the book that we're reading. I always love it when we get into a discussion and someone says, you know, I read that, and that got me thinking about this over here, so I started reading this book, and that kind of influences that discussion over here, and that's great. I love it when that happens. It's not required, but it is definitely we all benefit from that. And here's the thing. While I've prepared a lot for tonight, because this first night is designed to be the intro lecture for this particular study. It's designed to be, you know, the life and times of Newbegin, kind of the key points of his writings. What was he about? Beyond tonight, my preparation will be no more than your preparation. If you show up next month, you will have read the same amount of pages that I've read, and I won't have done any more than you have. Okay? So from here on out after tonight, it is 100% discussion based, which means it is all on you to make it a good discussion. If you haven't done the reading, I'd say, you know, just don't come back. It's okay. I still love you. If you get caught up by the next month, come on back the next month, and that's great. But this is designed to be discussion-based after the first night, so you have to do the reading in order to be a part of that. So what we're going to do tonight is we'll go through Newbegin's kind of life, and we'll go through a little bit of his writings and talk about kind of what his goals were. And then we'll talk about the schedule and kind of some of the rules for the road here in the course of discussion. Remember that each month we get going at 6:30, and it's always on the third Monday of the month. If your work schedule makes it so you have to get here at 6:45 or 7, totally fine. Just come on in, find a spot at a table. Next month, there's probably about 45 people here right now. Next month, about 30 of you will return, and so we'll bring it down to a couple of tables, and then by the time we hit December, there'll be about 20 of us, and we'll have a good discussion. So that's how it goes every time. Most of you will not make it to the end of this study. It's just the way it is. You won't be able to keep up. Life will get in the way. Your job will get busy. You'll find yourself maybe not as interested in the material as you thought you were going to be. You'll realize that you aren't really interested in studying books written by dead guys, and that's fine. I'm totally fine with that. Totally fine with you not making it to the next month. It's certainly nice to be in a full room, but I don't see this particular thing as being critical to your spiritual growth, and it's certainly not critical to the life of Terra Nova's success or failure. This is an extra, right? This is a bonus. So that's kind of the context of Theology at the Taproom. And by the way, I just want to say this really clearly. Don't let this be a substitute for anything else in your life, for a full life of following Christ. This is not designed to be a substitute for that. So why do we do this then? Here's my big overarching goal with this thing. If you ask me the question, Phil, how do you define success when it comes to Theology at the Taproom? Here's what I would say. First, my hope is that you will have a growing appreciation and respect for the great Christian thinkers and theologians of our past. Too often, we are focused, and I say we kind of in like a general church we. I don't mean one particular church, just we in the church. We often are too focused on the latest, greatest thing, the newest, shiniest book with the trendiest cover design, written by the most recent big name to hit the church. And certainly there is benefit in reading current books to know what is currently going on in our culture and how the church should respond. But what frustrates me personally is when the church kind of looks at anything that is 10 years old or older as being obsolete, right? At Terra Nova, we talk about being a historically informed church. That's kind of a big thing for us, and this is one way that we can do that. We can engage with the pastors, the theologians, the writers, the philosophers, the thinkers of Christian history, and that engagement can influence the way that we live our lives and our faith today. And it can lift us out of our little insulated, now-centered worlds and force us to come face-to-face with Christians of a different generation. And they can become guides for you from the grave. And that's a great thing. What we find when we do that is that we put on a set of lenses. We put on a set of lenses that somebody else wore 10 years ago, 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago. We put on a set of lenses and we read scripture and we understand truth through someone else's lenses. And we also, when we do that, we realize that our own natural set of lenses that we read those things through is a whole lot more clouded by our current situation than we realized before, right? And this is what we find when we look at a dead theologian. We look through their eyes. We realize that our eyes are probably not as accurate as we wish they were. And that helps us to get closer to the core of what really matters for us as Christians. When you realize that good theologians have been arguing over, for example, the mode of baptism for a couple thousand years, it makes you less likely to make that a hill that you are willing to die on, right? While you might have a strongly held opinion, you might be less likely at that point to say, I am willing to completely go to the wall on this one, right? When you realize that Christians have always struggled with the dichotomy of law versus grace, it should make us step back from overly dogmatic statements and criticisms of Calvinists versus Arminians. When you see a church father like Augustine having the same kind of doubts and crises of faith that we have today and surviving, it should give us some comfort knowing that we are not alone in our faith-related fears, right? We are surrounded by a great host of brilliant men and women of the faith who have written beautifully hard statements, amazing books and treatises, valiant steps forward in understanding the difficult parts of our faith. And to deny those men and women a voice in our lives seems foolish and arrogant. If I can help you see that through Theology at the Tap Room, then I consider this to be a success. That's how I know it's a success. And if you're someone who has stuck with me for two or three or four studies, then you've been exposed to multiple writers from multiple time periods and multiple perspectives within Christianity. And I try to stick to the big names. And when I choose an author, I try to stick to one of his or her most influential works. And that's the reason why I only read dead authors here. We only read dead authors because it's really hard to judge a person's long-term influence when they're still living, right? Sometimes they're really old guys. You can go, yeah, I think we'll be reading them 5 or 10 years once they say J.I. Packer. As soon as that guy kicks the bucket, man, we are reading one of his books. I'm looking forward to it, but not for now. This particular book that we're reading this fall is the youngest dead guy we've ever studied, right? So I'm kind of pushing at my own rule here a little bit. But this is one of those few times when you can look at a writer and draw a direct line from his writings to a distinct and rather influential movement. It just so happens that this movement is alive and well today. And, you know, to be honest, if I could be kind of somebody standing on the sides and looking at this movement and saying, you know, how much longer does it have? It's probably got 5 to 10 years of its apex, and then it'll start to kind of go down from there, just kind of the way movements are. But we're kind of getting ahead of ourselves there. We'll get into a biographical look at Leslie Newbegin in a few minutes here. We'll talk about his life and times and writings, the things he was most passionate about. And after that, we'll talk specifically about the book at hand, and we'll lay out the schedule and some ground rules. And before we go there, I want to just stop and give you guys an opportunity to ask any general questions about theology of the tap room before we go any further. Anyway. Nothing? All right. Good. We will get into Newbegin's Life and Times. If you want to read a short bio of Newbegin's life, I would recommend going to newbegin.net. It's kind of one of the primary websites for Newbegin. I can't say how well it was written because it wasn't a part of my research for tonight, but it looks like it's a relatively short treatment, so if you're looking to kind of get a little more detail, feel free to do that. Most of my research happened in Jeffrey Wainwright's book called Leslie Newbegin, A Theological Life. It is unfortunately out of print, but you can find it in a few places. I got it on interlibrary loan through Bob Nair, who comes here normally, and then I stole it and photocopied the entire thing because it's not in print, so I feel okay about that. If it was in print, I'd be happy to buy a copy, but it's not. So it's a decent book if you want like the 400-page biography. Newbegin wrote his own autobiography that you can check that out. I believe that is also out of print, but it's readily available on Amazon through secondary sources. If you want to read a good book on Newbegin's theology, good one here is Bearing the Witness of the Spirit, Leslie Newbegin's Theology of Cultural Plurality. This is a good book. He makes some decisions about what he thinks are kind of Newbegin's big deals, and kind of, in my view, maybe he goes a little too far on some of that. I'm not sure how accurate it is, but it's a good book. That's all on that stuff for now. That's a good book to check out. Let's get into Newbegin's life. You got some tools there you can check out for further study. Newbegin was born in 1909 in a place called Newcastle-on-Tyne in the UK. His dad was a shipping merchant. His mom was a mom, he seemed to have a pretty good upbringing. Never had any reason to question his parents' love for him. His dad, you know, spent time with him and taught him things like woodworking and model making. You get the impression when you read about Newbegin's upbringing that he came from a good home that was full of love, and that certainly set him off on a good path. As is the tradition in certain circles in the UK, Newbegin was off to boarding school by the time he reached what you and I would consider high school. Interestingly enough, it was a Quaker school, but he learned a great deal there. It was a really good experience for him. He talks a lot about some of the professors that had a huge, teachers that had a huge impact on him. And is often the case when a person goes off to school and starts to kind of spread their wings, you start to question some of the assumptions of your youth. Newbegin is no exception there. While he grew up in a solid Christian home, he, at this point in his life, was kind of abandoning some of the assumptions that he had about his faith and his religion. And is often the case, what you do is you kind of put everything on the table and you say, well, I'm going to study it all again for the first time. But then he read an essay called The Will to Believe by William James. And this seemed to be the thing that sustained his faith. There were some other writings by a Presbyterian pastor that really influenced him as well. He went on to Queen's College in Cambridge. And he made some great friends, got very involved in something called the Student Christian Movement. One summer he was working with an effort to help out the unemployed and those who were kind of down on their luck, kind of an inner-city mission almost. And he had kind of a religious experience where he suddenly felt like he understood how the truth of the cross of Christ reached down to the depths of humanity and offered hope. This was a major experience for Newbegin, and it influenced the rest of his life. That changed his life and his direction. He had a newfound confidence in his faith, and he began to get more and more involved in the church, and specifically what was called the modern ecumenical movement. He was connecting with Christians from all over the world and getting a sense of his place in this worldwide faith. He realized that the world was a lot bigger than he thought it was. He kind of got the focus off of himself, right? He realized at a young age that despite all the differences among the various flavors of Christianity, we really are all on the same mission. He joined the Presbyterian Church in Cambridge in the summer of 1930, and he heard an unmistakable call to become a pastor. He took a job with the Student Christian Movement, as I mentioned earlier there, that group he was a part of, and largely this was to pay the bills while he was studying to be a pastor. And that's where he met the woman that he would later marry. Her name was Helen Henderson. She was the daughter of an Irish Presbyterian missionary to India. So he marries her. He finishes his theological studies at Westminster College in Cambridge and got connected with a couple of movements that would later morph into the World Council of Churches. Many of you are familiar with that group. They've had kind of a checkered history. In 1936, he was given the go-ahead by the Church of Scotland to do missionary work in India. So he was ordained in July, and in September, he and Helen boarded a ship for India, Madras to be specific. Back then, a journey like that meant a 30-day trip by a steamship, right? So this was not, you know, you don't jump on the plane and catch a red eye and show up in your next location. This was a 30-day journey. So with not much else to do, he decided to write a book while he's on the boat for 30 days. So as he's headed off to India as a missionary, he's already writing his first book just out of seminary, 27 years old. And it was a kind of a rebuttal of another book that had been written that he disagreed with. Initially he's stationed in a small town called Chingleput, and later he's moved to another town called Kodai Kanal. It's Indian names. I'm probably botching it. You'll have to just forgive me on that. The whole time he's learning to speak the language of Tamil, or Tamil. He was due to be stationed in a place called Kanchipuram, and he was going to be there long term. When he suddenly had was involved in a bus accident, and his leg was smashed to bits. They tried to fix him up in India, but nothing was working well, so he ended up back in England for a lengthy recovery process. In all, he had 10 surgeries on that smashed leg, and this delayed him and his wife from their mission work for a couple of years. They managed to have a kid in the midst there while they were back in the UK, and that was the first of four kids total. And then finally, in late 1939, they returned to India to finally return to the work they had set out to do. Newbegin's desires for unity in the church found a good home in India. And he was instrumental in bringing together Presbyterians, Anglicans, and Congregationalists into what became the Church of South India. By the age of 37, Newbegin was elected as a bishop of this newly united church. This is, think about, several denominations coming together in India and saying, we're all going to work together. It's a great thing. A bishop's role is typically not something that you would achieve at the age of 37. So he was a very young bishop, and that's a testament to kind of the early wisdom that he had, somebody who was kind of ahead of his time in that sense. He was specifically over the area called Madura and Ramnad, and he faithfully served in that role for 12 years. His work in the ecumenical movement in India ended up making him kind of a well-known figure. This was something that was kind of an emerging movement at the time, And India was seen as kind of a poster child for what could happen on a grander, more global scale in that ecumenical unity movement. The word ecumenical can carry a lot of baggage today, but I think in Newbegin's early years, it primarily just meant working together. It's taken on a lot of other forms today, but back then, that's about the extent of it. It didn't have a lot of other hidden agendas. As a result of his role there in India, both as a bishop and as a leader in this ecumenical movement, he was often asked to be a consultant for various groups, and he was also a consultant for the very first assembly of the World Council of Churches in 1948. He was even asked to write the basic definition of unity that early effort of the WCC used in 1956. He sort of became a diplomat in a way, kind of a religious diplomat between the Church of India and the church outside of India, often attending and speaking at various conferences and often turned to as the resident expert. In the 1950s, Newbegin got very involved with something called the International Missionary Council. And here we start to see really a hint of his practical theology developing. The name of the conference was the Missionary Obligation of the Church. And that's a good summary of kind of, in one statement, of where Newbegin goes with his life. He later became the head of that group, and he found himself traveling between, for a few years at least, traveling between London, Geneva, New York, Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, Thailand, Japan, and other places in Europe and North America. He kind of just travels around there as a spokesman for this group. Interestingly enough, the whole time he's also maintaining his position as a bishop in India, but they kind of called him a bishop at large. He could kind of travel around, and he still kept his title there, but they were glad to have him out there in that role. Newbegin's fame and influence in the church, it kind of snuck up on him in a way. He wasn't somebody who was, you know, kind of angling for a good position. He wasn't somebody who was, you know, trying to put himself in a position where somebody would give him the next big role. That just wasn't his style. He just sort of steadily worked at whatever God had called him to do at that particular time. And people kept kind of throwing responsibility at him. He's one of those guys who had kind of greatness thrust upon him rather than seeking it out. He was just a gentle man in many ways. And you would not expect to find him in a role that often required some really hard words. Because despite his gentleness, he was also somebody that, when needed, could be very, very vigorous in his defense. He was very gentlemanly throughout that, but he was not afraid to tell you how he felt. He was the keynote speaker at a major convention in Australia. This is just a great little story about kind of his personality in the context of the spotlight. He was this speaker at this major convention in Australia, and one of the key organizers of this event said this about him years later. He said, "The unusual thing about Newbegin was the way that he could talk freely and firmly about matters on which we were divided, and yet instead of soon reaching the point where some of us would be gloating because we found that he was on our side, while others would be rejecting him, he just seemed to speak on and on, drawing us, all of us, into a continuing affirmative response." In other words, he was one of those guys who could just kind of unify people just with his tone. And he didn't kind of naturally create those divisions. In the end, he would tell people what they needed to hear. And in the case of this particular Australian convention, what he told them in the end was that your greatest need, you guys, is to be better theologians. Plain and simple, you're bad theologians. But, you know, I guess what's the phrase there? He had the ability to tell somebody how to get to hell and give them directions or whatever. I forget how that phrase goes. Anyway, in the 1960s, 60s were a crazy time in a lot of circles, right? Many parts of the world, and that included the church. Probably like a half a dozen of you were alive or can remember the 60s. I'm not one of them. But this kind of craziness included the church as well. And in the same way that people in America bought VWs and smoked pot and said, screw the man, in the church, the up-and-coming generations were looking at the institution of the church as something to avoid. This was very troublesome to Newbegin. He saw this anti-institutional attitude growing in those around him, in younger generations, looking at the church and saying, that's not something I want to be a part of. And it was troublesome to him because he recognized that if all you have is gospel and culture and you leave out the church, that's the three pieces of the Newbegin circle or triangle. If you leave out the church, you lost everything. You completely missed what God has called us to do and what Jesus sought to begin through the apostles. The church is not optional for our faith. It's foundational for our faith. He found that missions work was looked down upon by emerging generations in the 60s. Unity, this thing that he had sought so much for, this thing that he had put his life into, was almost seen as kind of a quaint thing to pursue. He speaks of this attitude that was emerging this way. He says, I was soon to learn that churchly, or being churchly, was an adjective of abuse, and that the only way to be really a part of God's work, as understood in the 1960s, was to leave the church behind. He wasn't saying that he agreed with that. He's saying that that's what he saw around him, that it seemed like those around him were saying the only way to be a part of God's work is to just kind of put the church aside. It's interesting that it was during this period that much of the parachurch movement emerged. Just a little side note there, something to think about. Newbegin eventually returns to a post in India, in the city of Madras, as bishop. So he's back there again in India. During that time, Madras had grown to 3 million people and was growing by 10,000 people a month. Very fast-growing city. He found himself in charge of well over 100 congregations. The group he was a part of had over 1,000 churches in India, greater India. But in his particular, kind of in his diocese, he was over well over 100 churches. These churches worked hard at living the mission of Christ, living the gospel in the city that God had placed them. Many were involved in serving the slums that would just pop up. Literally overnight, you think 10,000 people moving into a city every month, slums would just pop up overnight. Literally when like the cops had turned their backs, people would be building ramshackle homes. And there was no sanitation, no running water, nothing. And many of the churches that Newbegin worked with were looking for practical ways to serve these people. And it might be as simple as bringing in a proper toilet. They worked with the government to make sure that when a slum was designated for destruction so that proper homes could be built. Often those slums were built on borrowed land. That when something was designated for destruction, they would work with the government to make sure that the people were able to get out and get whatever small possessions they had out and into another piece of land somewhere, or even better, into proper housing. This was just kind of a snapshot there of the kind of things that Newbegin and the churches that he oversaw were a part of in India. They were really trying to live the gospel with those around them, looking around and saying, what does it mean to be the hands and feet of Christ in the area that we find ourselves? Well, this post takes him into the 70s, the 1970s, when he was, according to the rules set up for bishops, able to retire at age 65. Which is what he did in 1974. Throughout this time, he was doing a ton of writing about unity and theology, about life as a bishop in India, about all sorts of theological issues that he was concerned about. But everything he wrote clearly took on a tone of, what does this really matter today? In other words, it was always tied to practice. It was never something that was just done in a kind of an academic bunker. So, for example, in 1963, he wrote a book called The Relevance of Trinitarian Doctrine for Today's Mission. Right? You can hear, you've got clearly a doctrine that we've been studying for the entire history of the church brought into today. The Relevance of Trinitarian Doctrine for Today's Mission. In 1966, he writes a book called Honest Religion for Secular Man. Right? Again, theology, practice. In 68, he writes Christ, Our Eternal Contemporary. All of this writing, by the way, he wrote many more books than that. I'm just sort of giving a few titles that he wrote. But all of this writing was almost like a precursor for the more mature and developed statements that he would make later in life in some of his the writings that sort of are considered his best writings or his top writings. We'll come to that in a little bit. So Neubegin, in 1974, retires in September of 1974 in anticipation of my birth in December of 1974. No, he had no idea. So Neubegin is not someone who really knows how to retire, right? As is often the case with pastors. So he retires and immediately begins teaching at Selly Oaks Colleges in Birmingham in the UK. So now in his retirement, he's teaching future missionaries and pastors. His wife would have parties at their house on Sunday afternoon, and they would invite all kinds of students in, and he loved that kind of interaction. They both did as a husband and wife. And so on the side then, in addition to all of his teaching, he also became the national moderator for the United Reformed Church. It's also during this time that he writes one of his most influential books called The Open Secret. And the subtitle there is An Introduction to the Theology of Mission. An Introduction to the Theology of Mission. So it's The Open Secret. And when I was trying to decide which book of Neubegin that we would study, it was either going to be The Open Secret or The Gospel and Pluralist Society. And I went with Gospel and Pluralist Society because it is a later statement. Open Secret was written in, I think it was 78. Gospel and Pluralist Society was written several years later. So we get kind of a later statement of kind of the same thing. They're often seen as kind of similar. They're kind of making the same point. The other one's a little bit shorter and a little less developed. And then in his later work, we get a kind of a more full expression. So Neubegin returns to England, and he was struck when he looked around at the culture that he had left behind so many years ago, and he looks at the changes that have happened, he was struck by the direction that his home country had taken. Moral decay, a general despair among the people. And he couldn't take what he saw around him. He had to speak up on those things. But in addition to that, he found it hard to be stuck in the academic world. He longed to be with kind of regular people on a daily basis. Academic world can be an odd bubble. If you've spent any time in academia, you know that it can become this weird bubble that's set apart from the rest of the world, and you just kind of go about your studies, and it's like there isn't even a world outside. And unfortunately, seminaries can do that. So he just realizes, I need to get connected to people again. So he actually takes his own advice that he had offered to the presbytery that he was a part of. And he takes a job. This is his second retirement job, right? He takes a job as the pastor of this little tiny church that had dwindled down to about 20 people in a terrible part of town where mostly Indian immigrants were settling in droves. And as often happens in urban areas, you'll have immigration waves come through. And so a church might get going in a particular area of a city, and that church has a great influence for a period of time. But then the culture around that physical structure changes, right? And suddenly, they're completely off mission in terms of connecting with those that they're supposed to be serving. And so Newbegin comes in to this area that hadn't really been served by a solid church, and he looks around and says, what does it mean to speak the gospel here today? And he spends a number of years there, and ultimately he hires an Indian pastor, brings him over from India. The guy speaks like half a dozen Indian dialects, and this guy, threw Newbegin together, they're able to really connect together and serve the community that is changing. So this is how Newbegin then is living out the missional principles that he was writing about and gaining notoriety for. And he did this from 1980 to 1988 there in that little church. He continued speaking at conferences from time to time, and especially as he left that post in that church. He was often called upon for advice from major Christian leaders around the globe. In 1989, he writes the book that we're studying here, The Gospel in Pluralist Society. And this becomes his most complete statement of what it means for the church to always exist as missionaries. In 92, he tries to retire again. He and his wife buy a home near where most of their children live, so that they can be near their grandkids. But, of course, it never really works out very well for Newbegin. He continues to be called upon to speak to the church at large, and he remains kind of up to speed on all the issues of the day. In later years, he was viewed with such respect that his presence at conferences would overshadow any other speaker. He was getting up to speak at one particular conference, and this is, you know, he's well into his years here. He gets up to speak, and people there give him a 5-minute standing ovation before he can even open his mouth. Well, when the crowd finally stopped clapping, he just simply, you know, quipped with his English accent, "After applause like that, I can't wait to hear myself speak." So just kind of a good sense of who the guy was. People couldn't help but like the guy, right? He had just a friendly way about him. I searched around a lot to try and find some video footage of the guy. It's hard to find, despite the fact that he lived into the 90s. But I did get a hold of one DVD and watched him speaking. And he's just a gracious man to watch. You watch this guy and you think, I can't help but like this guy. He's just such a great man, and yet there's a sense of power there when you watch him. It's not weakness. There's strength, but it's a quiet strength. That's just kind of the kind of man that he was. He was quiet. He was meek in the best sense of that word. But if you were off in your theology, he was not afraid to pull you aside and correct you and help you understand the importance of having good theology. And help you understand why where your bad theology would lead you ultimately. His understanding of theology was always practical in that way. In late 1997, he had heart problems, which kept him home. And the next month, he died and went home to be with Christ. A year later, his wife Helen joined him there. In his passing, many people commented on how he seemed so close to the Holy Spirit. His prayer life was known by all, but he never talked about it. He wasn't somebody who bragged about his prayer life or anything. People just got a sense over time, those who knew him, that when he asked you a question about your life, he was asking because he was planning on praying for you. That night, the next morning, and until that need was met. That's just, again, the kind of man that he was. People commented on how, despite his many grand titles, he was never afraid to get into the fray of people's everyday needs. A good example of this was a time when he was stationed in India, and a major storm hit the area that he was living in there, and lots of buildings were destroyed. And he just jumped in, rolled up his sleeves, and helped out with the recovery effort, and rallied people together, people who were kind of walking around stunned based on this natural disaster. He just kind of rallied them together and said, all right, it's time to rebuild. Let's get going here. He pulled people into that. And yet, when a hard word needed to be delivered, he was not afraid to do that. He was speaking at a conference once, and he asked the organizers if they would like his speech delivered flavored with sugar or with salt. He just said to the organizer, how would you like this one, sugar or salt? He left that decision up to them. People noted that despite his developing theology, he remained completely focused on certain things as his constants. Christ's atoning work constituted the center of his theology. This was framed in a very Trinitarian understanding of God, and pointed always to God's work of reigning authority. The biography that I read by Jeffrey Wainwright breaks down Newbegin's life in this way, and I'm gonna paraphrase this, but I like how he kind of summarizes the different roles that Newbegin plays throughout his life. He says that Newbegin was an evangelist who believed that the gospel actually mattered to your life. He was an ecumenical advocate who sought the unity of the church. He was a pastoral bishop who loved people. He was a missionary strategist, always seeking to understand what it meant to take the gospel across cultural lines, both at home and abroad. He was a social visionary who believed that the gospel should impact the way we see and treat our fellow man. He was a liturgical preacher who sought the elevation of worship in the church. He was a scriptural teacher who could open up God's word and explain it with clarity and with wisdom. And he was a Christian apologist, always seeking to wrestle with modern and postmodern ideologies to show that the gospel is still just as meaningful today as it was some 2,000 years ago. This is the man that we're going to hang out with for the next few months. Now, I have to tell you that my knowledge of Newbegin's life does not go much further than what I've taught tonight. But I do want to take some time, if possible, to answer any questions that you might have about Newbegin's life. And by the way, if any of you have done some of your own study on Newbegin already in preparation for this, and you're able to answer a question that I'm not able to answer, please jump in with that. Any questions about Newbegin or his life and times? So the question was, aside from the William James essay, what other writers had a big influence on Newbegin? And, okay, I'm just going to kind of list off some of these. It's interesting. The guy who wrote this biography of Newbegin had a multi-decade relationship with Newbegin. And he noticed that he would be speaking somewhere and he would list two or three titles of books and he would say, these are the most important books you should read. These are critical. You have to read these books. And then next time you'd hear him speak, it'd be a different list. And so he finally just said to him, you gotta make the final list here. We need a list from you. But here's some works that that influenced him. There was one by Martin Fenn called Things and Persons. Buber's Ich und Du was quite decisive for the argument with scientific determinism. G.A. Studdard Kennedy's writings influenced him a lot. James Denny's book on Romans. Reinhold Niebuhr had a big influence on him, the Reinhold Niebuhr Gifford lectures on the nature and destiny of man. Kramer's The Christian Message in a Non-Christian World. Cochrane's Christianity in Classic Culture helped him understand the Nicene and Athanasian doctrine of the Trinity. Ramsey's The Gospel and the Catholic Church, Roland Allen, Missionary Methods, classic work, The Spontaneous Expansion of the Church and the Causes Which Hinder It, was also by Roland Allen. J.H. Oldham, Michael Poliani had a huge impact on him. Poliani, P-O-L-A-N-Y-I, had a huge impact on him. A.T. Van Leeuwen's Christianity and World History, written in 64. And then, I love this, he had had a goal for years of reading Barth's Church Dogmatics, or Barth, some of you might know it, Karl Barth. He finally got around to it in his retirement years. That was one of his retirement goals. So in 1974 and 75, he read Church Dogmatics, which is a big book. Okay, so this is like not bathroom reading. Other books. He lived recently enough to be exposed to N.T. Wright and found a lot of wisdom there. Especially liked the New Testament and the people of God. And Jesus and the victory of God. That is the extent of that list. So there you go. How's that? You're welcome to grab this and look at it later on if you want to. Other questions?
He really lived a tremendous span.
Yeah.
It seemed as though he was active for a good part of that.
Yeah.
What was his...
Born in 1909, died in 98. So yeah.
A lot happened in that period.
Yep.
What was his take on the contemporary ecumenical movement today?
You know, I wasn't able to find a good answer on that, to be honest. He attended a conference, a later conference of the World Council of Churches in the 60s, and walked away completely disgusted by it. Just kind of a wholesale rejection of some of the basic tenets of Christianity. And kind of just an odd embracing of the world. So in some sense, he wasn't a fan of it. But I think probably he would probably fit more with that category than say other categories in Christianity.
Is he read in seminaries today? And if so, what kind?
He is. He's read in a few different types of. Well, he's read in just about every kind of seminary. But he would be read often in mission classes. So if you're taking, say, a global missions class, you may read Newbegin. Additionally, and I'm far enough removed from seminary that this didn't really hit me in my time in seminary, but Newbegin was rediscovered in the mid to late 1990s. And someone once said that seminaries lead from the rearview mirror. So it takes about 10 years for a seminary to catch up to what's actually going on in the culture. So right about now, seminaries all across America are starting up classes called Missional Theology, and Newbegin is no doubt a primary text there. So right about the time that Missional Theology is passé, they're getting on the board with that. So that's typical of the seminary world. So other questions? So Jim is asking if he mentioned anything about the Christian school movement. I read nothing about that. Sorry. Jim has a Christian school in his church, so it's a good question.
And I was struck by, this is very succinct, you know, in a few sentences he was able to encapsulate the disastrous effect of the Enlightenment upon Christian thinking. And I was just wondering to what extent he had really studied the history of that period, or did he derive that from other authors?
I think he probably got it from other authors. It seemed like he was somebody who took other people's advice on what books to read very highly. His biographer commented that he didn't necessarily read widely, but he read very deeply. So, you know, I'm somebody who reads a lot of different books, and I probably only catch 25% of what the author said. He seems to be somebody who read more deeply. When it comes to the issue of enlightenment, I'm not exactly sure where he kind of got a lot of that from. But I think Pugliani was probably one of the sources for that. I don't know if anybody else has read Pugliani, but... What? How do you feel like Pugliani would impact that? If I'm putting you on the spot, don't worry about it.
Yeah,
you can just say no. I don't know.
Pass till next time.
Okay, sounds good. You'll come back. You'll do a little more research on Pugliani. Sounds good. Yeah, and by the way, on some of those sources that were like key writings for Newbegin, I'd love it if people just kind of picked up some of those and read them between now and the end of our study and kind of speak on how that works. Some of you I know love to do that extra study, and some of you don't have time, and that's totally cool. But question back there? Say that again.
Did he read
Chesterton? I don't know. I hope, well, you know, Chesterton was writing in newspapers, right? So that'd be like, you know, of course he read Chesterton. It's like you pick up the London Times and you're reading Chesterton. So I would assume he read Chesterton.
This may be a little early, but is there anything in his work that makes you uncomfortable?
Newbegin falls into a category of broader evangelicalism. He probably might not even describe himself as a true evangelical. That is not entirely where I line up. So there's probably some secondary issues of theology that he and I would disagree on. Or maybe a better way to say it would be that some of the things that are important to me, he couldn't give a rip about, and that's fine. So. And that's kind of, you know, Newbegin's church context is what is referred to as the mainline churches. Mainline churches are things like Presbyterian, Anglican, you know, Episcopalian. There are often some theological views that would be different from where I would stand. So, other questions? His dad was a shipping merchant. And so I would assume that would probably, in that time period, would probably put him in lower middle class, is my guess. But his parents sent him away to school, so that probably indicates that they had a little bit of money. Anything else? Questions about Newbegin's life? Sure. All right. What I want to do here is just take a few minutes to talk about, kind of bring Newbegin forward those last 10 years since his death. And kind of ask and answer this question: Why is he already so recent from his death, already so important in the history of the church? I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this. You can do further study on this. But what we find is that in the 1990s, especially in the Western Church, kind of a new wave of ideas begins to shape the next generation of leaders and pastors in the church. And I'm not going to get into this in detail, but suffice it to say that one of the key ideas that this new emerging, which is kind of a buzzword, generation of pastors recognized was that mission is not something that we do over there, wherever there is, but it's something that we live on a daily basis. And this might seem like, you know, a no-brainer for others, but there was a period in the church where many didn't understand that. Many did, but many didn't. And so for much of Newbegin's life, because he was in that mainline kind of category that I talked about a minute ago, he was often not really embraced by conservative evangelical churches, especially in America, unless they happen to also be a part of that mainline group, a mainline denomination. But in the late 80s and early 90s, Newbegin is rediscovered, so to speak, and it's partly in response to postmodernism thought reaching the church. And suddenly books like Gospel in a Pluralist Society and Open Secret become a rallying call for guys like Daryl Guter, who recently after Newbegin's death wrote kind of a seminal work called The Missional Church. For those of you who are kind of up on church trends, missional is like the buzzword. It's like we're getting sick of it at this point, but it's kind of the buzzword that like everybody uses. But the missional church movement is something that that Newbegin is often really kind of considered the father of. And so you have guys then like Mark Driscoll, who wrote Radical Reformation, and others like Chris Shea or somebody like Rob Bell or Brian McLaren. These guys fall into a broader category of the emerging church, different from emergent. Emerging, emergent, different. Google it. But at one point they were on the same page. And they found their beginning to a large extent in an organization that started during Newbegin's life called the Gospel and Our Culture Network. And the key word there is our. The Gospel and Our Culture Network. It's pretty simple, right? We are churches, and we're connecting the gospel to culture. So Newbegin lives on today through churches that fall into that movement. His words became a call to action in that sense. And that's kind of why I wanted to study this book now. In our last study, we looked at the Apostolic Fathers, who, in my view, I'm not someone who is Greek Orthodox, so in my view, the Apostolic Fathers were movement leaders of their day, kind of those first, second, and to some extent third century movement leaders. So what I thought would be interesting, kind of as a juxtaposition, would be to go from the Church Fathers, movement leaders of the early church, to a man who is often called then the father of the missional church movement, which is probably the biggest movement to hit the church in recent, say, in the last 15 or 20 years. So that's kind of why I chose to do this book now and how Newbegin comes into today. Any questions on that? We're running out of time, so I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time answering those questions, but if you have a couple short ones.
I've just dropped these because I've got tables and I'm a
totally fine, Heather, no problem.
And I wanted you to have them.
No problem at all. Questions on that? Go ahead, Jeff. I know you got one burning. No? All right. All right. Here's what we're going to do. We're running out of time. We're going to take a little bit of time to talk about how this works. I already talked about how next month when you come in, there'll just be a few tables. They'll each probably be a little bit smaller than they are, especially this one here. And you'll just find a spot and jump into conversation. Some of you will be table leaders.
Bill won't be sitting up, so.
I won't be sitting up on a big bar stool next time. And I won't have a microphone recording me either. You'll just come in and grab a spot at a table. Those of you that have been table leaders in the past, come and check with me afterwards and just let me know if you're able to be a table leader again. If you're interested in being a table leader, come and talk to me as well. And what I'll probably do is just schedule out a couple of people for each one. So if we have three tables for next month, probably two tables at the one after that, and two tables at the final one. So that's about how many I need. Being a table leader, all that means is that you come prepared to lead the discussion. So rather than just doing study for your own, you kind of put some benchmarks down throughout the writing to say, hey, let's stop here and talk about this. That's what being a table leader involves. So we'll come in on October 19th for our next study, and you'll have 88 pages to read for that one. And then the next one around, it's about looks like it's about 90 in November, and then it's about 65 in December. Here's a few things to keep in mind as we go through this. One, if you can't commit to reading ahead, you just know you're not going to be able to get that done between now and next month. Or 3 weeks go by, and you realize that you're on page 4, and you've got a major exam coming up in 5 days, and it's probably not going to happen. This may not be for you right now, okay? If you can get caught up by November, great. Try again some other time. Try next semester, whatever you want to do. But let me just say this in a really clear way, and I'm not trying to sound like a jerk when I say this, but showing up having not done the reading is just not acceptable. I just would rather you hang out at the bar and have a beer downstairs. All right? Okay, number two. The tap room pays their staff with money, right? Spend some each time you come here. Order beer, dinner, soda, whatever, but just don't order water with a lemon wedge. By the way, Jeff is kind of the, hope you don't mind me saying this, Jeff. Jeff is kind of the second in command here for theology at the tap room. He is kind of my right-hand man here on this stuff. So he's always, you feel free to ask him questions too. In the next study, Jeff will be leading the next study. What do we decide on, Jeff? That's right. We're talking about Aquinas for winter and spring. So, yeah. Jeff will actually be leading that next study. So order something when you're here. If you plan on drinking, no problem with that. I'm a big beer fan. Know your limit. Okay, no one likes a drunk theologian. It's just not pretty. Okay. Number four, bring cash. Okay, it just makes it easier for everybody. Number five, please represent Terra Nova well here. Only heretics tip poorly. Please tip 20% or more. And number six, most important of all, do not embarrass us by ordering light beer. Completely unacceptable. Okay? You can order beer that is light in color, but not, you can't order Coors Light. Simply not allowed. Refuse to see it in the room. Okay? Any questions at all?
I'm going to need a biblical reference on the last couple.
I've got one for you. I've got a whole chapter I'll send you. Actually, there's a great chapter in Mark Driscoll's book, Radical Reformation, called The Sin of Light Beer. And he actually has like a whole, he gives you the whole history of how light beer came about and how it's a terrible, anyway. So, it's good fun if you're into that. Any other questions at all? Is anyone still needing a book? Other than Nasser? Anybody? Great. Nasser, you can get your book from Sean. Guys, thanks for coming out.
Guys, we'll see you in a month.